The Rats in the Walls by H.P. Lovecraft. Read by Mike Bennett. Part 2. The vault was very deep in the foundations of the priory, and undoubtedly far down on the face of the beetling limestone cliff overlooking the waste valley. That it had been the goal of the scuffling and unexplainable rats, I could not doubt, though why, I could not tell. As we lay there, expectantly, I found my vigil occasionally mixed with half-formed dreams from which the uneasy motions of the cat across my feet would rouse me. These dreams were not wholesome, but horribly like the one I had had the night before. I saw again the twilit grotto and the swineherd with his unmentionable fungus beasts wallowing in filth, and as I looked at these things they seemed nearer and more distinct, so distinct that I could almost observe their features. Then I did observe the flabby features of one of them, and awakened with such a scream that Black Tom started up, whilst Captain Norreys, who had not slept, laughed considerably. Norreys might have laughed more, or perhaps less, had he known what it was that made me scream. But I did not remember myself till later. Ultimate horror often paralyzes memory in a merciful way. Norreys waked me when the phenomena began. Out of the same frightful dream, I was called by his gentle shaking and his urging to listen to the cats. Indeed, there was much to listen to, for beyond the closed door at the head of the stone steps was a veritable nightmare of feline yelling and clawing, whilst Black Tom, unmindful of his kindred outside, was running excitedly round the bare stone walls, in which I heard the same babel of scurrying that had troubled me the night before. An acute terror now rose within me, for here were anomalies which nothing normal could well explain. These rats, if not creatures of a madness which I shared with the cats alone, must be burrowing and sliding in Roman walls I had thought to be of solid limestone blocks, unless perhaps the action of water through more than 17 centuries had eaten winding tunnels which rodent bodies had worn clear and ample. But even so, the spectral horror was no less. For if these were living vermin, why did not Norreys hear their disgusting commotion? Why did he urge me to watch Black Tom and listen to the cats outside? By the time I had managed to tell him, as rationally as I could, what I thought I was hearing, my ears gave me the last fading impression of the scurrying, which had retreated still downward, far underneath this deepest of subcellars, till it seemed as if the whole cliff below were riddled with questing rats. And Norreys was not as sceptical as I had anticipated, but instead seemed profoundly moved. He motioned to me to notice that the cats at the door had ceased their clamour, as if giving up the rats for lost, whilst Black Tom had a burst of renewed restlessness and was clawing frantically around the bottom of the large stone altar in the centre of the room, which was nearer Norrie's couch than mine. My fear of the unknown was at this point very great. Something astounding had occurred, and I saw that Captain Norreys, a younger, stouter, and presumably more naturally materialistic man, was affected fully as much as myself, perhaps more because of his lifelong and intimate familiarity with local legend. We could for the moment do nothing but watch the old black cat as he pawed with decreasing fervour at the base of the altar, occasionally looking up and mewing to me in that persuasive manner which he used when he wished me to perform some favour for him. Norreys now took a lantern close to the altar and examined the place where Black Tom was pawing, silently kneeling and scraping away the lichens of centuries which joined the massive pre-Roman block to the tessellated floor. He did not find anything, and was about to abandon his efforts, when I noticed a trivial circumstance which made me shudder, even though it implied nothing more than I had already imagined. I told him of it, and we both looked at its almost imperceptible manifestation with the fixedness of fascinated discovery and acknowledgement. It was only this, that the flame of the lantern set down near the altar was silently, but certainly, flickering from a draught of air which it had not before received, and which came, indubitably, from the crevice between floor and altar where Norris was scraping away the lichens. We spent the rest of the night in the brilliantly lighted study, nervously discussing what we should do next. The discovery that some vault, deeper than the deepest known masonry of the Romans, underlay this accursed pile, some vault unsuspected by the curious antiquarians of 3 centuries, would have been sufficient to excite us without any background of the sinister. As it was, the fascination became twofold, and we paused in doubt whether to abandon our search and quit the priory forever in superstitious caution, or to gratify our sense of adventure and brave whatever horrors might await us in the unknown depths. By morning, we had compromised and decided to go to London to gather a group of archaeologists and scientific men fit to cope with the mystery. It should be mentioned that before leaving the subcellar, we had vainly tried to move the central altar, which we now recognized as the gate to a new pit of nameless fear. What secret would open the gate, wiser men than we would have to find. During many days spent in London, Captain Norris and I presented our facts, conjectures, and legendary anecdotes to 5 eminent authorities, all men who could be trusted to respect any family disclosures which future explorations might develop. We found most of them little disposed to scoff, but instead intensely interested and sincerely sympathetic. It is hardly necessary to name them all, but I may say that they included Sir William Brinton, whose excavations in the Troad excited most of the world in their day. As we all took the train for Anchester, I felt myself poised on the brink of frightful revelations, a sensation symbolized by the air of mourning among the many Americans at the unexpected death of the President on the other side of the world. On the evening of 7th August, we reached Exham Priory, where the servants assured me that nothing unusual had occurred. The cats, even old Black Tom, had been perfectly placid, and not a trap in the house had been sprung. We were to begin exploring on the following day, awaiting which I assigned well-appointed rooms to all my guests. I myself retired in my own tower chamber with Black Tom across my feet. Sleep came quickly, but hideous dreams assailed me. There was a vision of a Roman feast like that of Trimalchio, with a horror in a covered platter. Then came that damnable recurrent thing about the swineherd and his filthy drove in the twilight grotto. Yet when I awoke, it was full daylight, with normal sounds in the house below. The rats, living or spectral, had not troubled me, and Black Tom was still quietly asleep. On going down, I found that the same tranquillity had prevailed elsewhere, a condition which one of the assembled savants, a fellow named Thornton, devoted to the psychic, rather absurdly laid to the fact that I had now been shown the thing which certain forces had wished to show me. All was now ready, and at 11 a.m. our entire group of 7 men, bearing powerful electric searchlights and implements of excavation, went down to the subcellar and bolted the door behind us. Black Tom was with us, for the investigators found no occasion to despise his excitability, and were indeed anxious that he might be present in case of obscure rodent manifestations. We noted the Roman inscriptions and unknown altar designs only briefly, for 3 of the savants had already seen them, and all knew their characteristics. Prime attention was paid to the momentous central altar, and within an hour Sir William Brinton had caused it to tilt backward, balanced by some unknown species of counterweight. There now lay revealed such a horror as would have overwhelmed us had we not been prepared. Through a nearly square opening in the tiled floor sprawling on a flight of stone steps so prodigiously worn that it was little more than an inclined plane at the centre, was a ghastly array of human or semi-human bones. Those which retained their collocation as skeletons showed attitudes of panic fear, and over all were the marks of rodent gnawing. The skulls denoted nothing short of utter idiocy, cretinism, or primitive semi-apedom. Above the hellishly littered steps arched a descending passage, seemingly chiseled from the solid rock, and conducting a current of air. This current was not a sudden and noxious rush, as from a closed vault, but a cool breeze with something of freshness in it. We did not pause long, but shiveringly began to clear a passage down the steps. It was then that Sir William, examining the hewn walls, made the odd observation that the passage, according to the direction of the strokes, must have been chiselled from beneath. I must be very deliberate now, and choose my words. After ploughing down a few steps amidst the gnawed bones, we saw that there was light ahead, not any mystic phosphorescence, but a filtered daylight which could not come except from unknown fissures in the cliff that overlooked the waste valley. That such fissures had escaped notice from outside was hardly remarkable, for not only is the valley wholly uninhabited, but the cliff is so high and beetling that only an aeronaut could study its face in detail. A few steps more, and our breaths were literally snatched from us by what we saw, so literally that Thornton, the psychic investigator, actually fainted in the arms of the dazed man who stood behind him. Norris, his plump face utterly white and flabby, simply cried out inarticulately, whilst I think that what I did was to gasp or hiss and cover my eyes. The man behind me, the only one of the party older than I, croaked the hackneyed, "My God!" in the most cracked voice I ever heard. Of seven cultivated men, only Sir William Brinton retained his composure, a thing the more to his credit because he led the party and must have seen the sight first. It was a twilit grotto of enormous height, stretching away farther than any eye could see. A subterraneous world of limitless mystery and horrible suggestion. There were buildings and other architectural remains. In one terrified glance I saw a weird pattern of tumuli, a savage circle of monoliths, a low-domed Roman ruin, a sprawling Saxon pile, and an early English edifice of wood. But all these were dwarfed by the ghoulish spectacle presented by the general surface of the ground. For yards about the steps extended an insane tangle of human bones, or bones at least as human as those on the steps. Like a foamy sea they stretched, some fallen apart, but others wholly or partly articulated as skeletons. These latter, invariably in postures of demoniac frenzy, either fighting off some menace or clutching other forms with cannibal intent. When Dr. Trask, the anthropologist, stopped to classify the skulls, he found a degraded mixture which utterly baffled him. They were mostly lower than the piltdown man in the scale of evolution, but in every case definitely human. Many were of higher grade, and a very few were the skulls of supremely and sensitively developed types. All the bones were gnawed, mostly by rats, but somewhat by others of the half-human drove. Mixed with them were many tiny bones of rats, fallen members of the lethal army which closed the ancient epic. I wonder that any man among us lived and kept his sanity through that hideous day of discovery. Not Hoffman nor Huysmans could conceive a scene more wildly incredible, more frenetically repellent, or more gothically grotesque than the twilight grotto through which we seven staggered, each stumbling on revelation after revelation, and trying to keep for the nonce from thinking of the events which must have taken place there 300 or 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 years ago. It was the antechamber of hell, and poor Thornton fainted again when Trask told him that some of the skeleton things must have descended as quadrupeds through the last 20 or more generations. Horror piled on horror as we began to interpret the architectural remains. The quadruped things, with their occasional recruits from the biped class, had been kept in stone pens, out of which they must have broken in their last delirium of hunger or rat fear. There had been great herds of them, evidently fattened on the coarse vegetables whose remains could be found as a sort of poisonous ensilage at the bottom of the huge stone bins older than Rome. I knew now why my ancestors had had such excessive gardens. Would to heaven I could forget. The purpose of the herds, I did not have to ask. Sir William, standing with his searchlight in the Roman ruin, translated aloud the most shocking ritual I have ever known, and told of the diet of the antediluvian cult, which the priests of Sibylle found and mingled with their own. Norreys, used as he was to the trenches, could not walk straight when he came out of the English building. It was a butcher shop and kitchen. He had expected that, but it was too much to see familiar English implements in such a place, and to read familiar English graffiti there, some as recent as 1610. I could not go in that building, that building whose demon activities were stopped only by the dagger of my ancestor, Walter de la Poore. What I did venture to enter was the low Saxon building, whose oaken door had fallen, and there I found a terrible row of 10 stone cells with rusty bars. 3 had tenants, all skeletons of high grade, and on the bony forefinger of one I found a seal ring with my own coat of arms. Sir William found a vault with far older cells below the Roman chapel, but these cells were empty. Below them was a low crypt with cases of formerly arranged bones, some of them bearing terrible parallel inscriptions carved in Latin, Greek, and the tongue of Phrygia. Meanwhile, Dr. Trask had opened one of the prehistoric tumuli and brought to light skulls which were slightly more human than a gorilla's, and which bore indescribably ideographic carvings. Through all this horror, my cat stalked unperturbed. Once I saw him monstrously perched atop a mountain of bones, and wondered at the secrets that might lie behind his yellow eyes. Having grasped to some slight degree the frightful revelations of this twilight area, an area so hideously foreshadowed by my recurrent dream, we turned to that apparently boundless depth of midnight cavern where no ray of light from the cliff could penetrate. We shall never know what sightless Stygian worlds yawn beyond the little distance we went, for it was decided that such secrets are not good for mankind. But there was plenty to engross us close at hand, for we had not gone far before the searchlight showed that accursed infinity of pits in which the rats had feasted, and whose sudden lack of replenishment had driven the ravenous rodent army first to turn on the living herds of starving things, and then to burst forth from the priory in that historic orgy of devastation which the peasants will never forget. God! Those carrion black pits of sword, picked bones, and open skulls! Those nightmare chasms choked with the pithecanthropoid, Celtic, Roman and English bones of countless unhallowed centuries. Some of them were full, and none can say how deep they had once been. Others were still bottomless to our searchlights, and peopled by unnameable fancies. What, I thought, of the hapless rats that stumbled into such traps amidst the blackness of their quests in this grisly Tartarus. Once my foot slipped near a horribly yawning brink, and I had a moment of ecstatic fear. I must have been musing a long time, for I could not see any of the party but plump Captain Norris. Then there came a sound from that inky, boundless, farther distance that I thought I knew, and I saw my old black cat dart past me like a winged Egyptian god, straight into the illimitable gulf of the unknown. But I was not far behind, for there was no doubt after another second. It was the eldritch scurrying of those fiend-born rats, always questing for new horrors and determined to lead me on even unto those grinning caverns of Earth's centre, where Nyarlathotep, the mad faceless god, howls blindly in the darkness to the piping of two amorphous idiot flute players. My searchlight expired, but still I ran. I heard voices and yowls and echoes, but above all there gently rose that impious, insidious scurrying, gently rising, rising as a stiff, bloated corpse gently rises above an oily river that flows under endless onyx bridges to a black, putrid sea. Something bumped into me, something soft and plump. It must have been the rats, the vicious, gelatinous, ravenous army that feast on the dead and the living. Why shouldn't rats eat Adelapur as Adelapur eats forbidden things? The war ate my boy, damn them all, and the Yanks ate Carfax with flames and burnt grandsire Adelapur and the secret. No! No, I tell you, I am not that demon swineherd in the twilight grotto. It was not Edward Norrie's fat face on that flabby fungus thing who says I am a Delapore. He lived, but my boy died. Shall a Norrie's hold the lands of a Delapore? It's voodoo, I tell you. That spotted snake. Curse you, Thornton. I'll teach you to faint at what my family do. Splud, thou stinkard. I'll learn ye how to gust. Wald ye swink me thilk ways. Magnamata, magnamata. Attis, dia achaidas ad oidan. Agas bas dunam. Nach ort, donas, dolas ort, agos liatsa, hungul, hungul, rur kachaka.
That is what they say I said when they found me in the blackness after 3 hours. Found me crouching in the blackness over the plump, half-eaten body of Captain Norris, with my own cat leaping and tearing at my throat. Now they have blown up Exham Priory, taken my black Tom away from me, and shut me into this barrelled room at Hanwell with fearful whispers about my hereditary and experiences. Thornton is in the next room, but they prevent me from talking to him. They are trying, too, to suppress most of the facts concerning the Priory. When I speak of poor Norris, they accuse me of a hideous thing. But they must know that I did not do it. They must know it was the rats, the slithering, scurrying rats, whose scampering will never let me sleep. The demon rats that race behind the padding in this room and beckon me down to greater horrors than I have ever known. The rats, they can never hear. The rats in the walls.
thank you for listening. The music on the podcast was by The Laughing End. Follow on Twitter at The Laughing End.